Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, damas y caballeros, leave it in.
And welcome back to another edition of Leaving the Ring Radio. I'm your host, Dave Duenas, with my co-host, Mr. Gabriel Montoya. It's a beautiful day out there in Northern California. I'm pretty sure it's beautiful over there in Southern California. In the East Coast, I don't know how it looks out there, but normally it's always cold. Anyways, you know, I haven't had coffee, dude, for like, I think I'm going like maybe 2 months. And I decided to do it today, and I don't know if I'm talking really, really fast because I'm all caffeined out right now. And I got to tell you, dude, I forgot how much I love coffee. And as we got a good show for everybody here on Leaving the Ring Radio. We're going to have Ann Wolf with her prospect, Black Magic, with us here on Leaving the Ring on the first hour. On the second hour of the show, we're going to have Brian Tui, who's the writer of The Fix Is In and the Larceny Games. Really interesting stuff. I think he's going to bring some really hot topics to the table to Leaving the Ring. It is a different direction with this interview, because he's going to be talking about the NFL, to the NBA, to the Major League Baseball, to NASCAR, of how games are fixed and how, you know, the corruption. There's a lot of stuff going on in that. If you tune in every chance you can to Leaving the Ring, you've heard me talk about the Boxing Blitz and how I'm doing these segments. And I was originally going to put him on the Boxing Blitz, but I thought that this interview was probably big enough for everybody to kind of share in and listen to what Brian Tui has to say. And and of course, we have a lot of topics here to talk about here on Leaving the Ring. We also got some predictions about this upcoming week's fights. We got some rants of our own that we got to kind of break down here on Leaving the Ring Radio. Really, really quick, man. Richard Schaefer taking a low blow to Oscar De La Hoya, saying that it's part of his rehab program that he has to go back and, you know, basically say sorry to all the people that he's, you know, did wrongdoing to, right? So, you know, you remember last week we had mentioned how I think it was Woody from ESPN had asked Oscar De La Hoya, hey, how's everything going? Oh, everything's fine in the Golden Boy world. And we were just like, you know what? He's not going to tell you the truth. The thing about Richard Schaefer, man, is hate him or love him, you know, there's no filter on him. He almost kind of acts like he's an ex-boxer himself, Gabriel. You know, the way he rebuttals somebody else's answer, the way he carries himself, he reminds me of the old school gangster that feels like he's just untouchable in a way. I don't know. What are your thoughts about him and his answer back to Oscar De La Hoya trying to make peace?
Yeah, I think it shows, you know, more and more people I talk to, it seems like it's a done deal that there's some sort of split and that, you know, there's been a peace made of a kind. But that it's not a lasting peace. It's just until the pay-per-view is over and they kind of squash their story and then we'll see. But if you really look, but you know, read between the lines, yes, sir, that was interesting. Schaefer coming out and going, I didn't sign an extension till 2018. And maybe that shows that maybe Oscar offered that and it was turned down. But then, you know, Schaefer made the crack about, you know, about his recovery and that he was making amends, essentially. But I thought the most important thing that he said yesterday, Richard Schaefer, was talking about Sean Porter being next in line for Floyd Mayweather and already kind of beating the drums for that. It was significant for two reasons. One, it shows you that the 11-1 favorite, Floyd Mayweather, it shows the worth of this next pay-per-view against Marcos Maidana, which is really nothing. It's a great shot for Maidana, and if he pulls it off, kudos to him. You know, bigger upsets have happened in the sport, but we've seen this script before. Devin Alexander has been able to do it. Amir Khan's been able to do it. I don't see any reason why Floyd Mayweather shouldn't be able to do it. But what it was saying, more than that, you know, beyond just how crappy that pay-per-view is Sean Porter is not a Golden Boy fighter. He's an Al Haymon fighter. Floyd Mayweather's not a Golden Boy fighter. He's an Al Haymon fighter. They're pitting this guy, you know. Now, Marcos Maidana is with Golden Boy and with Heyman. But the next fight, here you got basically Richard Schaefer saying Golden Boy is not involved it's going to be an all-Heyman affair for Floyd's next fight. I think that's a significant thing for him to say. And, it, you know, I'm not going to indict him right here, but it's just interesting to see the CEO of a company who seems to have made, the founder of the company, Oscar De La Hoya, angry, that you wouldn't be turning around and trying to say, look, I have the company's best interest at heart. But instead, first thing you do is mention a fight between what some people may perceive as the problem in the relationship, Al Heyman. At some point he's going to have to, I don't know, maybe, as one person said, he may get pushed into a position where Al has to make his own promotional company. But certainly it doesn't seem like, Schaefer doesn't seem like a guy that wants to make peace. And I think the rest of the industry is just watching this because, as I think I said the first time we talked about this, it's going to be interesting to see how valued Richard Schaefer is without Oscar. Does Al need him that much that he brings him along to whatever thing he's going to do in the future if he decides to do that? Or do they just jettison him and the relationship between Oscar and Richard could grow? But when you look at it, it's very interesting to see that there have been fighters that have been developed on Golden Boy's, I don't know if it's their dime. That's a good question. It's whose dime has it been? Has it been the network's dime? Is Al coming out of pocket for it? But there's been a lot of, like, Al Heyman-only fighters that have been developed on TV cards, not just, any old boxing cards, but TV dates, that if this split happens, Golden Boy gets no piece of. And Golden Boy doesn't have paper on. They're just Al fighters, but fighting on Golden Boy, quote-unquote, cards. It's an interesting situation to see how it all pans out in the end. I don't think it's as simple as Oscar just saying, you know what, guys, I don't think this is one of those Oscar should have thought before he tweeted or got lawyers. I think this is a guy that really wants his company back and doesn't like where his CEO took it. And you can make a few arguments that the CEO has actually done a very good job raising, the Golden Boy name. But if you look deeper, as I just did, whose name, whose property did they really raise the value of? That's the question.
Well, you know what? I mean, I think it's fair to say there's a lot of egos in that promotional company. Schaefer obviously feels – I think there's some sour grapes with Oscar just because of the fact that Oscar has an addiction. He's been away where he's kind of left a load for Schaefer to deal with. And I think that's why Schaefer is giving him the shun. He's giving him the shoulder just because of that factor there. You know what? Listen, any good businessman is going to go into a deal – not because he likes the person, not because the relationship is solid and tight. Money talks. We've all heard that expression, money talks. And that's what Schaefer did. So this, to me, is just coming into fruition where we're starting to see that with Schaefer, that there was really no true liking in his part. This wasn't about being buddy-buddy with Oscar De La Hoya, the Hall of Famer. This was about making money, and a lot of money. And we're seeing that more and more with Schaefer. And can you blame him? I couldn't blame him. But is it distasteful in the way he's going about the business, being so openly about it? Absolutely. What other businesses out there really kind of take jabs at the other president or CEO? Or in that case, I think a lot of the battling is done in court. We haven't seen this happen yet between them two, but I think we're pretty close to it where they go to court and they end up going through this divorce and finding out who has the child, which would be the promotional company.
Yeah, and again, it's why I point to Schaefer's behavior is something that everybody else should be looking at is that look how if this was kindergarten, they wouldn't check the box, very, very high on, works well with others. He just doesn't seem, Schaefer doesn't seem to want to get along with the rest of the industry. He wants to be kind of separatist. I mean, Bob, there's a big fight on the table, and he's basically just saying, absolutely not. I don't want to. I've been down that road with Bob Arum. I don't want to go down it again. I mean, every fight is a different road. There's a lot of roads in boxing. How can you say that? I absolutely don't want to work with this person. And it's like, what does that say to the rest of the industry? Like, maybe they don't want to work with us either. Maybe this isn't the. He kind of forgets himself, and that he ended up in a very advantageous position, being at the top of Golden Boy, who was being somewhat subsidized by HBO, was really put in a great position.
Right, right.
But, Schaefer, and he's built the company into something. Anybody could, those companies are hard to keep going, and bigger names have failed, certainly. Not bigger names, but other names have failed in the business, legitimate names. Sugar Ray Leonard is certainly a big name that didn't last as a promoter. Roy Jones certainly has not made a large impact. But at the same time, Schaefer acts like, you know, he's that kid that you know, hit a triple, thinks, you know, or, you know, was born on third and thinks he hit a triple. It's like, dude, you were hired into this company, and you kind of act like you're really a boxing guy. You run this company, but I've always looked at Schaefer as something of an outsider to the business. And the way he treats everybody is kind of that way, as if they're the outsider. It's not a really long-term way of running your, you know, setting up relationships and wanting to run a business. I have a hard time believing that he'll last through all this. He might end up being a casualty that kind of parachutes out with some money, and that's it.
You know, of all the
nothing
stupid
would
reality
make me
shows,
I gotta be honest.
You know, of all the stupid reality shows that are out there, like even with the boxing new reality shows, I haven't even bothered to sit down and even try to watch them. I kind of wish there was a Golden Boy reality show so we can kind of see what's going on between both of those characters, you know, and you can get a little bit more insight of what's going through their mind, you know, because there's only so much that we can gather and try to create the storyline of what's going to happen next. But this is real. I mean, like we said last time, we've said this numerous times, this is very interesting in what's going to happen and how Al Haymon plays out between these two, because to me, Al Haymon is just sitting in that shadow, just waiting for these guys to both explode and lose eye on the prize, and he sneaks up behind and he thieves it away. You know, and rightfully so. Al Haymon is doing a great job by swallowing up the competition. He's right there in the mix, but he really isn't. He's got the Watson twins. He's got Sam Watson. He's got his pawns, and he really knows how to play the chess game of business when it comes to doing something like this. You know, Brian Fogg, who's a writer for Leaving the Ring, he calls him the necessary evil for boxing just because of the things that he's able to accomplish and do. And here's another thing is that I tweeted out, if, you know, we talk about the fights, the Cold War between Top Rank and Golden Boy, you know, and all these great fights that have not been materialized because of this Cold War. Well, if Al Haymon continues to do what he's been doing, which is signing fighter after fighter, well, he kind of eliminates that Cold War, and we might end up with these fights that we've been wanting and asking for quite some time. So there's some interesting parts that he brings into this whole web of what's going on between all these promoters. And he may be the light down that tunnel, man, unfortunately. He may be the light down that tunnel.
Yeah, but that's kind of like waiting for Floyd to take a tough fight, you know? And it was always kind of like, well, let him get to this Oscar fight, you know, like it was always like the next fight. Well, this fight's preparing for this other fight. That's why he's facing this guy. And then it was, you know, he's not facing Margarito now because he's making a move towards Oscar. But, you know, as soon as he gets his position solidified as a pay-per-view guy, then we're really going to see the big fight. And, like, we haven't seen the good fights. We haven't seen – I don't look through that DVD collection and go, these are the fights that I want to see. It's when I look at Al – I'm not really banking on, depending and based on what I'm seeing, on it getting better. I mean, maybe at a certain point when he has all the talent and you've got to recycle guys and eventually you just see it. But there seems something missing anymore from the sport that things were built towards. Fights were promoted towards, you know, in tandem. It doesn't. Maybe it's too early. You know, it's the beginnings of the Showtime thing. Maybe we need 2-3 more years to really see it take hold or not. So, you know, I've always kind of said, let's take a long view of all this, of Floyd moving over, of Espinoza at Showtime. But, I mean, Kovalev versus Adonis Stevenson, just based on their ages alone, that fight's never going to be better than it is right now. One guy is like 30, the other guy's 37. That fight didn't happen. As good as Al Haymon is, or is purported to be, why hasn't Pacquiao Mayweather happened? And that's a fight that will never be as good, you know, and I don't care what anybody says. And Pacquiao, yeah, he's got something left, and Floyd's got something left, but they were at the peak of their abilities at that point. They were at that point where they could still physically give, you know. I think at 37 now, at Pacquiao 35, I don't know that we would get it would probably be a classic if they went toe-to-toe. What I'm trying to say is we could have gotten three, I guess. You know, what they have left to give is probably good enough for one good one if they give us that kind of fight. They probably won't. I think the fight wouldn't live up to expectations anyways at this point. back then.
There's no It's no longer like back in the 1920s and 30s, 40s and 50s where it was a fight for the hunger game. And what I mean by that, you know, they were fighting for a purse. They were fighting for to live. Now it's pretty much to have a storyline for what's next and to savor what is in your bank account, you know, and to keep a certain image. That's what boxes came along. You know, like I said, we're going to have Brian Toohey on, and something really interesting that I was reading about how the NFL had argued in a case that they were in trial about how they're a business of entertainment and how they had it. Basically what they were saying is that they're it's really not a sport. They create stories to entertain, to get people to sit down. And boxing is in a lot of ways is in the same light as that. They're in the same avenue of creating a storyline, kind of like what, you know, WWE does. You know, it's a story that you're buying. You're not buying a fight. You're actually not buying a competition between two guys in their prime. You're buying the story, what they bring to the table, and that's what we're being fed, and that's what we get excited about. And then when it comes to fight night, we're left with blue balls, if that makes any sense. I don't know.
Well, there's a lot of things is that, you know, Al has all the talent. Maybe we start seeing the fights. When you look across the street at the UFC, and more guys are coming out and not happy with the kind of money that they made. And I find it hard to believe that it's all just they screwed up how they spend their money, you know. I have to think that the amount of money that the UFC is making, being a consolidated company and a league, the fighters should be making more than they do. At least that's what they're valued at, is, you know, it's a several billion-dollar company. I think it's a $2 billion company, the UFC. They make a lot of money. And so I look at it and I say, okay, these guys don't have a union.
Right.
They don't have universal, you know, anything. No uniform drug testing. In fact, Dana White, who, you know, he just kind of plays the heavy more often than not. The other night came out and said, oh, you know, thank God that's all passes now that, you know, TRT was such a nightmare. And it's like, no, people asking you about it was a nightmare, and you having to constantly, you know, dodge it. The one thing I worry about, you know, with the TRT ban from the ARP is that it pushed the users back into the dark. What it didn't do was increase, you know, the level of drug testing across the board. It just took away this drug, permission to use a drug. Now everybody just, you know, they're just going to go, you know, black market, which is probably what they were doing before anyways on some level. But looking at this whole thing, you look back to boxing with Heyman, like, okay, it's slowly taking form into a league, all controlled by one guy. Has that really worked out for the UFC? How great has that been for them? How great has that been for their fighters? Do we even know, you know? And having real no control over your destiny, boxing used to be, I mean, politics and everything were involved, but you were kind of fighting your way and choosing your way in a sense. It doesn't sound like that's always the case over there.
No, it isn't the case. I mean, even boxing always had a storyline. We all had a storyline that we bought into, but in that storyline, we had some real action. We had some real gladiators going in and fighting for that bone. It's not like that. You know, I mean, here's a good example is Sean Porter did a fantastic job by blowing out Paulo Malignaggi. Very impressive in what he did. He really bullied him, mauled him up against that corner. And the case could be that Pauly got old overnight or because Pauly has been successful with an Adrian Broner. That being said, it kind of leaves the question out there that's thrown up in the air, how good Adrian Broner really was. Well, the titles obviously are a shadow or you know, smoke and mirrors of trying to convince people that these guys are actually better than what they really are. And then we kind of find out where they stand. Where I'm going with this is now that Sean Porter destroyed Paulo Malignaggi and he looked just more beastly at 147, now we're talking about Floyd Mayweather. Why are we talking about that? He blew out an older veteran, which he was supposed to do. If remember this, back in the days in the 80s and even in the mid-90s, the young champion would get an older champion, and that's how we determine how good he really was. If he lasted 12 rounds with them, a lot of us were going like, well, he's not that good. You know, he should have been able to blow him out of there because the guy had older legs. You know, he's up there in age. He's been in the ring too long. This is the way you push an old champion into retirement. Sean Porter did that. He did exactly that. But should we be jumping up and down and raving whether or not he should get Floyd Mayweather right now? I don't think so. I think that, you know, it should be still questions to be answered by Sean Porter. He should have the ability to get in there with a Kell Brook or a Keith Thurman or like a Robert Guerrero. Other names out there, Amir Khan, guys like that, to find out exactly where he is and help him kind of develop where he's going. Granted that Floyd only got another year, another three fights, but, you know, that's enough time in my opinion. It's a year and a half before we find out where Sean Porter really stands. For him to be talked about as the next fight, or people are demanding as the next fight, Gabriel, I think that fans jump up and applaud a little too quick. They start that wave down the stadium a little too early.
Yeah, I want to see the Kell Brook fight with Sean Porter. That's his mandatory. It's a good fight. I think Brook's got some nice skills and will bring out some things in Sean. It's not an easy fight, and he's a young guy who's going to have to be taught to lose, you know, in order to beat him. I think it's a really fun fight, and it's a losable fight for Sean. Let me call in Ann Wolf here. She's waiting for me to call her in. So just...
Okay. Fight fans, you want to call in 347-215-7598. Don't forget to download the app to your mobile phone on your Apple or Android and tune in to all three shows that we have on the podcast here, which is The Next Round, Boxeo Tijuana Radio, and yours truly here, Leaving the Ring Radio. We're going to bring on Ann Wolf here on Leaving the Ring once again.
We're back, Dave.
Okay.
So I'm here live with trainer Ann Wolf and to discuss, you know, her ever-expanding stable. She's always developing folks. I remember writing a couple of years ago that Ann Wolf was developing an army out there in Austin, Texas, and they're just kind of waiting to come of age, you know, one at a time, and now one of them has, correct me if I'm getting the name wrong, Travell Mazion, Black Magic is his nickname, and he just had an electrifying performance on TV last week. So we welcome Ann. How are you today?
Oh, I'm good, but his name is Travell Wolf because I adopted him. So he when they announced him, all the work hadn't went through.
Well, there you go, Travell Wolf. That's actually a better sounding name. This Wolf is just how many, you were just gifted with a cool last name, man. It's one of the lucky things that you've had along your way. You've had one of the better stories of all time in boxing, just from your beginnings. How you saw the woman on TV and realized that you know, you can get paid for that, and immediately went and became one of the more storied fighters of not just female boxing, but I was looking to just put you in the whole pantheon. I don't think it's fair to kind of separate you out. But as a trainer, it's been a little bit harder because you've had James, and he's kind of made bad decisions. It's really kind of stunted his growth. He could have been something, and that just remains to be seen. But let's talk about Travell and how you two came to each other. Take us to the very beginning of that.
Travell, I first opened the gym in about, because I told Brian I want to help kids and I wanted to just make sure the kids didn't go through what I went through. And about, my gym had been open maybe 6 months, and this little kid, little black, ugly-ass little kid came in, and he couldn't be no more than 3 feet tall. He was 7 years old. And he was a badass little boy because he would just go, you know, like he was real ADD and hyper. And so I spun the first year whooping his ass to try to make him be still. And he just kept coming and coming. His mom would bring him. And then I noticed after the first year, his mom wouldn't come. So I asked his brother, would he bring him? And so he would bring him a little bit. And then after that, he wouldn't come. And by the time Travell was 10, he got me. He pulled a knife on a little girl or something like that, and he got in real bad trouble. So I told Pops we'll go pick him up, and we started picking him up when he was 10. And he stayed in the gym, and he stayed still getting in trouble. But when he was in the gym, he wouldn't be in as much trouble because, you know, I always had about 50, 60 kids in the gym taking to the fights. And, you know, he's still at 14, 15, he still had to look up to me. And when he turned 14, he got into some more trouble because he said he wanted to go play basketball or whatever at school. And his mom said, okay, we're just going to let him go play. And I was like, if Travell comes out the gym, he's going to get in trouble. He got in trouble again. He didn't steal a car, but he took a car with his friend. He was 13, driving a car up the road, got in trouble. Then he came back, and at 14, he got some kind of something was wrong with his liver. So he still started coming. He still come to the gym every day, but I didn't let him box. At 14, 15, or 16, he didn't box because I didn't know what was wrong with his liver. And they found out it was some kind of just like a deficiency, and they gave him medicine. He's okay. So the last time he stayed away from the gym, he was 16, and he got in trouble at school. And he's not a cute kind of kid to get in trouble. So I went to the school, and he was a senior, because this was when he was a junior. I said, you keep on getting in trouble. Every time you leave the gym, you get in trouble. I said, you're going to have to fix whatever it is that's going on with you, because you need to be in the gym, because, it's, you know, he had never seen his dad. His mom worked, and then she's not really there. And I'm like, listen, I'll help you get out of this trouble. I said, but I tell you what, anybody that deal with me box anyway, so you don't have to be a boxer, but you're going to have to go to the gym and box or clean the gym or do whatever. I said, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to take care of you the whole – his mom didn't even know who the teacher was or none of that. So from about 16, I said, I'm going to take over everything. I'm going to make sure you finish high school, and I put 100 kids through high school with no fella, no baby. And I told him, I said, from his being in the summer of him going to the 12th grade, every morning I said, you're getting up and you're running 8 miles, and I don't want to hear, because my kids do what I tell them to do. They don't do what they want. So I started getting them up and making them run 8 miles every morning before they get to school. I go have lunch with him in the evening. I make him train the younger kids, and then I train for 4 or 5 hours. So then come around, he was 16, just turning 17. I said, we're going to put you back in the boxing. So when he came back to come back to boxing, he had just turned 17 for about a month. Like, it might have not even been 16. And so back then in the amateur boxing, you had to fight grown-ups if you were 17. So if they were 35, you had to fight them, no matter. Just so happened, Texas had the number 1, 2, 3, and number 4 guys in the United States in the amateurs. So his first 2 months back, he fought a kid that got like 100-some fights. He wins the fight, but
oh, wow,
they don't give him the fight. I said, don't matter. You won the fight, they didn't give it to you. Okay, so we go to LBC. It's this kid that came up. His brother name is his name is Steven Bermontez. He's Jerry Bermontez's brother. Steven Bermontez had 130 fights. At this time, Chevelle was at like 23 fights. So he beat Steven. He beat Steven, and everybody was like, he only been back for two months. But he beat Steven. So then Brian Carl, which is the white kid out here they call Cowboy, he beats everybody in the B side, and we beat everybody on the A side. So Cowboy just signed with Al Heyman. So we get to the finals. Chevelle's just turned 17. Cowboy got 140 fights. So they were like, Cowboy used to fight some of my older guys because he like 23, 22, right? Chevelle burned his ass up. So they like, what in the hell is going on? We go to the National Golden Girls. We go throughout the whole entire National Golden Girls. We meet up with Marquise Taylor. He's had 120 some fights. Chevelle burns him up. Then we meet up with the kid that's ranked number one in the world. He's like 240 fights. His name is George Rincon. We get a 2-3 split loss. To me, the fight was a draw. I don't think it could have went either way, so we said we'll give it to George, even though he got 200 and some fights and been all over the world. Okay, we go back, and we've got to go through the LBC. Now, Cowboy went and beat George Rincon when they went to the Nationals. So we go through the LBC. We beat everybody. Guess who we beat? Guess who we find at the Nationals? I mean, at the state. I mean, in our region. Here comes Cowboy again. He burns his ass up again 2 weeks later. Marquise Taylor beat Cowboy. We met him at the state. He burns Marquise up. So we're on our way. We're the state champion. We're on our way to the Nationals. They changed the rule for the amateur boxing saying if you're not 17, you got to fight 17, 18. You can't take the headgear off or nothing. You got to be 19 or above. We would have had to stay with the headgear on for 2 full years. I said, Chevelle, we're not going to be running 8 miles, sparring 80 rounds, you know, training this and fighting for 3 minutes. I said, might as well turn pro. So at 17, I said, you want to turn pro? He said, yes, ma'am. I said, well, it's time to bounce. First pro fight. They call. Top rank wants to look at him. They give us a guy. He got pro. It's his pro debut, our pro debut. Chavelle knocks him out. Okay. Then they call me on a Thursday and say, can you be to a weigh-in Friday to fight this guy? He's 2-1. They say, you always stay in shape. We got the call at 6 o'clock. We got in the car from the gym and went straight and went to the weigh-in. The guy was 2-1, first round, Chavelle knocked him out. So then we just kept on fighting, and I told Golden Boy, I said, listen, and I called Cameron Charlie, but I said, they top rank don't think I got nothing. I know what I got. I said, when the kid, I looked at the kid in a year, the kid grew 2 feet in 1 year.
Whoa. Wow.
I said, this kid is 6 foot tall, and he can make 135. He made 130. But then he started growing a little bit, so I said, I run him every day. I feed him about 5,000 calories, and he runs like a gazelle because I run him every day. And I said, he grew so fast, so, you know what I'm saying, but he still stayed skinny. And he just got reflex like cat. So then we start sparring and sparring and sparring. And we sparring people that's 16-0 and 15-0 and 12-0. He's crashing them all, eating them alive. You could line them up. And he would just he'd go through them because the way we train, the way I tell them, and the way I make them train, the way I tell him, but see, since he's been doing it since he was 7, it's in his soul. So he'll go run 9 miles. He ran 9 miles like today. And then we'll go train for 4 or 5 hours. And then we'll go in there and I'll hit you till you can't move. Then we'll eat some more, sleep some more, wash dishes, cut grass, and go train some more. And he's never going to get tired. Because he trains, that's all he do. He never had a girlfriend. So they looked at the shot, they said, well, he took one hellacious ass right hand. Because he's in top shape. He made a mistake. I said, why did you throw that? You got hit with an overhand right. He said, I knew he didn't have no power. He says, but I knew one thing. Once he hit me, he made the mistake of thinking that I was to be dropped or gone. So once he made the mistake to hit me and thinking I'm gone, I ain't gone. I'm always, every single second in that ring, I tell him, you got the opportunity to sleep his ass, and he got the opportunity to sleep you. So if he hit you and he think he's going to do something, drop him. If he don't hit you, crash him. If he get tired, knock his ass out. If he hit you hard, hit him harder. So every day after practice, what I do is we do what's called a burnout. After you do squat thrust for 20 minutes, then you do whatever. I try to make you stay on in a push-up position, just on your hands and knees, for an hour. Don't move.
Oh, wow.
So, watch your ass. And so that's how I come up with that. James just got to the point he just couldn't handle the training.
Let me ask you this, Ann. When you put these kids through a regimen, is it to kind of filter out who you think has the heart to go to pros or to go to the next level? Is that why the training is so difficult and so stringent? What was that?
Nope. I got 50 kids in my gym right now. I do whatever I want. They know I love them so much. If I tell them to fight a grown man, they'll just die to fight them. It's for me to stop when I know they're going to fall or break. You don't break them. You take them to the brinks of breaking them and then you stop. So if Chavelle can stay up for an hour and this kid can't stay up for 10 minutes, you let this kid up at 9 minutes and 59 seconds. And you don't try because everybody's not going to be a boxer. So what we do is we get them prepared to go to highs. I got kids that they went through my gym that got master's degrees. I got over 30 kids that I put in the military. But when they get to the military, guess what happens when my kids get to the kids that come through my gym get to the military? They start off when it comes to anything, they the best. Can't no drill sergeant tell them nothing or do nothing to them. When I have business people go to the business meetings or whatever, they says I eat their ass up, and they can't handle me at all. They can say whatever they want to say to me. You know, my girlfriend, she works for the state. She eats them alive because you prepare them for all walks of life. When they get to school, somebody a bully. Shit, bully one of them kids from my gym. They're not
right.
a bully. They're going to pick you number one. Why are you being a bully? You should just come to – because they're smart, too, and why would you pick on somebody even smaller than you? So I don't have no kids fighting school. My daughters, I don't have to have no problems with men or this or that, nothing, because the way I raise my kids and the way I raise the kids in the gym. You don't try to break them. You try to get them to be stronger and stronger and stronger. I don't just bring them in there and just break them. I'll build them up a little bit at a time. Terrell couldn't run 8 miles in 53 minutes when he first started. He started in like, when he first started, he first came back, guess how long he was sparring? 15 seconds.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, 15 seconds. That was it for the first 2 weeks. And I moved to 30 seconds. Terrell can stand flat-footed and spar 15 rounds because I build it up.
Right.
I didn't just go do it. You got to get their muscle and their body and their mind. You got to build their mind up into being a strong mind.
Well, you're saying to get that frenetic pace, too, because that's a telltale sign of to me, of a wolf fighter or yourself when you're fighting, is that really up-tempo. You guys go right to the hottest point of a fight. If you look at it, he's still very controlled. He uses his jab beautifully and uses it like a weapon.
He still hadn't settled down.
Yeah.
Once he would have settled down, you would have seen what he's capable of. But with
right.
us, his tempo, that ain't even a real tempo, because he would have started putting that tempo on you and that pace on you that he'd just be like, fuck. There's no way this kid can keep this kind of pace up for no damn 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And you'll be like overwhelmed. You'll be like, there's no way he could do it. And you're going to find out, yes, it is, because that's what we do at the gym. Why? Who wants to see a boring-ass fight? And
nobody
once
does.
Everybody sees the kid, they're going to see that the kid is in control. He'll make you miss. His defense is very good. He just stood there. He said, I was going to throw a bowl. I said, why? He said, I know he ain't had no pop. I said, man, you ever do that again? He said, yes, ma'am. I said, you ever do it? The type of jab you got, you better not ever do that shit. He was like, yes, ma'am. I said, shit, you make him eat them damn jabs. I said, you can fight a whole fight without getting hit. Why are you going to get hit? He could move his head once I told him to start moving his head, but he 18, he still was kind of antsy. He wasn't settled. He was antsy. But I tell you what, you hit somebody that comes from where I come from, if you don't knock them out, oh, they're coming back with something. Because every single time James Tuckman got dropped, what did he do? Get up and knock your ass out. And when he was with me. So if you hit one of them with something, you can best believe they're coming back with something, because it's in the blood of us. You should see them spar. You would think they hate each other.
And they've been doing that, I mean, like you said, like you develop them 15 seconds, 30 seconds, mm-hmm. since they were kids. I mean, he's been going at it for a very long time with the same kind of philosophy, right?
Yes. So the other day I got a stench cord, right? And
mm-hmm.
so, because a lot of the kids coming back, the older ones, like the men, because we're doing a nonprofit show. So they're going through this retarded regimen, right? And I was like, so y'all want to stop? Do you want to just quit and not do it? I said, to Isaiah, I got the extension cord, a thick-ass extension cord. I said, turn and hit you on your back with this extension cord, see how hard it hurt. You see if it hurt. So he turns around and hit him on his back. He said, shit, that hurt worse than trying to do this, man. You get to do this. So I hit Travis, said, hit me too, Miss Ann. So I turned around and hit him on his back. Like, shit. And the Mexican kid called Johnny, I hit his ass across the back. I'm talking about put wraps on it. They were like, you got to do it, because there's only one way to win a fight or a boxing match with us. You have to sacrifice and suffer. If you don't sacrifice or suffer, you're not going to win. You're going to have to not eat, not drink. You're going to have to suffer. And the more you suffer, the better you're going to want it. And mentally, the better you want it. If they're better than you, be in better condition than them.
Well, let me ask you this, you know, with that, you know, and that's, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's about.
You have to know pain.
You have
you
to.
You don't know no pain. Listen, when black people were in the 50s and the 60s and the 30s, when they couldn't even walk on the sidewalk or they just slept off the damn side, when they, you know what I'm saying, they
yeah.
walked, when they were doing the boycott, they worked 15 hours and walk home because they didn't want to ride first. They had something to fight for. They had something they wanted. It's something that they wanted. When the soldiers from the United States go over and fight for us, it's something they want. They'll die. So when you go box, you have to have something to want it for so bad that you're willing to go above and beyond what everybody else is doing.
Do you think that
still true.
James,
yeah.
I mean, during that training all those years, I mean, is it that he just dreads going back into what he's going to have to sacrifice, or is it something else?
Nope, it's something else. No, it's in his soul. No, what it is when you have a kid, that's why with Travell I teach him. You got a kid that ain't never had nothing his whole life. No money, no shoes, no clothes, no pants, no nothing. And you hand them $100,000, $200,000, they're not going to know what to go do whatever. The rest of their little friends coming, and then they ain't never had a cake. They'll go buy the fucking bakery.
Right.
They ain't never got to get their own soda. They'll drink 10 sodas. They ain't never had to get a pair of shoes. Give me 100 of them. That's what that is. It's not about the training part or this. It's about being able to know how to be successful. Because you teach a kid how to win and this, but you got to teach them how to spend the money, how to be successful, how to walk and talk and be successful. You cannot, you know, I knew how to be successful because of my mom and dad. Even though we were poor, my dad got to where he made a lot of money. You have to know how to have money. You can't give a kid that ain't never had money $500,000 and think he just go, hell no, he's going to go stay up all night, spend that shit, and do everything else.
Damn,
right.
Down the toilet. Yeah.
He was ugly. No girls want to talk to him. Now the finest hoes in the nation is right there. Like,
right.
You know what I'm saying? They don't know how to handle it.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
I was going to ask you, what is the latest with James Curtin? And I mean, the last time we spoke to you, it sounded like you guys had a plan to move forward on, but that's the last we've heard of it.
With me and James Curtin, it's kind of like y'all guys, and I'm a woman, and you know how you go through that thing with your mom and your dad, and
yes.
I'm kind of going through with my oldest daughter. I'm always here for you. But as long as you're here with me, you're going to listen to what I say because my advice is good advice. And my advice is going to help you. But you go ahead on out there and you find out for yourself what's really going to happen to you. And I'm going to be here and you're going to abide by the rules that I have when you get back here. I'm not going to throw it in your face that I told you you're going to fuck up and fall on your face because you need to know that. Some kids need to know that. My other daughter's
right.
In college doing her business just telling me, you tell me what to do, Mom, and I'm going to do whatever you tell me to do. My other kid is not bad. She just needs to go find out for herself. 23 years old, ain't never been out and about, so she needs to go find out. And that's
so this is just right, so this is a case of Kirtland kind of being a knucklehead, trying to find himself and try to man up. And you're basically telling him, hey, this is the path you should take, but he's being stubborn. He doesn't want to do that. He wants to find out the hard way, right?
He's not even being stubborn. Some people just got to find out for yourself.
Right.
Well, what's
how frustrating
for,
is that for you,
path?
Though?
If my mom told me, listen, I was in the middle, right? Mama told me, listen, don't go outside. I'm going to whoop your ass, right? I go outside, take the ass whooping. The next day she said, don't go outside because we'll whoop your ass again. I didn't go outside.
Right.
But my sister would have went outside every time thinking she'd get away with the shit and hurt and get back in the house when my mom come. I just said, hell with it because my mama going to come and she whoop my ass because I know it. But she was like, nah, I'm going to go around the other side and she ain't going to see me. I said, you can get your ass whooped. And so you got kids, you got people with personalities that just think, oh, I can do this and you can't. And you let them go bust their head and everything, and then here they go again. It just comes from the upbringing. It really comes when you see kids and people like that. I come up in a strict home where my mom suffered for us, and she was there for us. She whooped our ass with a belt, and she told us that we don't do this. We be respectful. We give our person our word. We keep it. We respect the Lord. A man don't work. He don't eat. And the whole nine yards. And we live by that. That's how I train Travell and my children. Well, if you get a kid like James, he lived in the streets when he was young. He did this. He lived by the street rules. That's the only rules he knew. And until somebody teach him that this is not the street, this is business.
Right.
Because I didn't do it both ways.
Right.
But
no.
If you look at boxing, guess what? It's like they're fucking selling straight crack. Because all the promoters, both the promoters, the managers, and everything else is like the mob. So you got to have some portion of that that kind of mentality. But guess what I found in boxing? With every promoter I deal with, most managers and everything, I'm honest as hell, right? If I tell you I'm going to do something, I do it. So don't wear up over me. But if you don't do it, I'm going to get all over on TV and I'm going to tell them. And everybody going to know that you wrong because they know I shoot straight by the gun.
That's true. Very true. So let me ask you, how frustrating is it for you for in Kirtland, who could be something just beyond what he has shown us? And how much longer do you stay by his side and give him this tough love?
It's not frustrating at all. Why would it be frustrating? And listen, my mama died when I was 18 and she was 43. That was frustrating. That hurt my soul. Just because you don't want to go box, I don't give a shit. I care about a little pissy-ass kid that's 6 years old that mama's on crack, daddy don't be there. I'm going to take that kid and I'm going to put him through high school. I'm going to put him through and let him get a good chance to make it in this world. That is more important to me than somebody fighting. I don't give a damn. I care that this kid get the opportunity to make if he can come up through here and I'm in the gym, I'm going to make sure that kid go to school if he wants to, go to college if he wants to. I'm going to make sure that kid get the opportunity. I get more frustrated when the parents get in my way of letting me help these kids than I do because somebody don't want to box. Somebody don't want to get on TV and punch another person in the face. Who gives a damn? I care about these children. That's what everybody don't know about me. Fuck boxing. I don't even like boxing, really. What about the lost people, the lost kids in the United States who mama and daddy on crack, who don't have no mama and daddy, that's what I care about. I don't give a damn about no boxing. But guess what boxing do? It allows me to make more money so I can help more kids. Because once upon a time, I was that kid. Once upon a time, I was eating out the trash can when my mama died. I don't want nobody to feel that. I don't want a kid to be able to feel what it feels to be so hungry you just don't know what to do. I want Travell has the opportunity. Travell don't never, ever, ever have to be a street thug, got no tattoos. He ain't never slept with no girl. He ain't going to make no bunch of babies all over the place. I don't give a damn if Travell don't win no world champion. I give a damn if he don't be no man. He can stop boxing today as long as he be a man.
That's
what people don't know about me.
You know, I think every time we get you on and we're lost of words because, you know, I mean, you know, you're an inspiration. I honestly can say that you're an inspiration.
I don't care about boxing. I don't care about boxing. Boxing is something that attracts. They be attracted to it. They be like, oh, because it's what they see. It's violent in a way, but then it could be nurturing in a way. And right now I got about 60 kids right now. 60. And I go to their school. I try to teach their mama how to take care of them. Travell is going to fight May 17th because we're having a thing for the nonprofit. I have a nonprofit. I volunteered over 400,000 hours. I didn't give about $1 million of my own money. I pay like $4,000 every month for a gym to stay open. Some of the kids sleep in there sometimes.
And these are all kids that are just like children of the drug war, in a sense, in one way or another.
A lot of them parents come from Mexico and they can't make a lot of money.
Mm.
A lot of them are from the hood. Some of them white kids. Some of them every color kid. Then I got some, it's just they find that family-oriented thing in it. They got moms in my gym, dads, old people, young people, families. And I make this one, okay, he don't have a daddy. You're a dad. I'm going to train your kid because you want a fighter, but you're going to be a father figure to this kid right here. You want me? You got a lot of money. You're the judge, right? So you're going to show this kid that all judges, I got police officers in there. Oh, y'all want to train? Y'all want me to train y'all because y'all want to go on TV? All right. show this kid how you're supposed to treat a son. All right, so I got people in there with a lot of money. Willie Nelson, he be in there, Connie in there, all of them. And so I'd be like, this is, so when Travell came, this is how moms and dads do. This is what they do for their kids. You know what I'm saying? So then you want me to train you? You got a lot of money? Okay, this kid don't got no money. You need to love him and show him and hug him and give him what he need. I train you for free.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's right. Great.
That's fantastic stuff.
Let's ask you about your prospect.
The last
what's
thing
your
I'll
from?
Say is I don't like boxing. I don't like the way it's handled. I don't like the way it's portrayed. I like the old school boxing. But
right.
This shit,
I'm with you on that. Yes.
Mismatches and very diluted.
Yes.
No, but it was a poor man's sport. You had a chance to make it because you didn't have to go to college. You didn't have to be in the nothing. You could make it. It was a poor man's sport. The good man became the champion. Whoever was the better of the athlete. Now you could be a sorry motherfucker, raggedy, sorry, and be a world champion.
Yeah. Yeah,
you're two shades from being a faggot, and you could be a world champion.
Wow. And whoop on the ring.
I'm glad that, not me. Yeah, she can get away with it. But, I mean,
you know what I mean. Hard men that fought to the death were world champions.
Yeah.
The Hagglers of the world. They're no longer here.
Looking like no fucking kangaroo, like a rooster and all that shit on and, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
I agree.
It's
fighting bums.
And even stuff like, and not to disrespect the guy, because he's actually a good person, but like Andre Berto, he had like 7 defenses of that WBC welterweight title. That's a belt with a storied history. But you look at the guys he faced, and the amount of money he made was a ton for the level of competition that he faced. And that's just not the way it would have been done, I don't think. And I don't think he would have ever been a title holder. He would have had to fight for it. But we're getting these kind of
go back
fast
to the old school. You could have, how many losses can you have and still win a world title? Now you got 3 losses, you're dead, and you're shot, you're gone, you can't do shit. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
They fighting every other fucking twice a month. Sugar Ray Robinson lost to Jake LaMotta. Then he came back 13 days later and fought. And then 6 days later, he whooped Jake LaMotta's ass.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean,
couldn't
agree with you
happen.
More on that. You know?
They need to fight. They need to let them fight. You can have 30 losses and still win a world title. Shit. Let them fight. And then you'll develop better competition. Don't just put them and let them. Right now, I'll match Travell here, get the shit knocked out of him. Get your ass up, let's go. You lost, let's go. Don't think he's gone because he lost, don't. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah, we'll look at Kirkland.
You're trying to develop a fighter.
No, I agree. I 100% agree. It's there's a matchmaking deficit going on, at least at one of the companies. And just an overall. It seems like guys have been fast-tracked, microwave careers, and overhyped. And just, again, at the top, the pay-per-view mismatches, the whole thing. It's not the boxing I grew up loving. That's, you know, for sure.
Nobody wants to do it anymore. Boxing should have a whole deal like everybody else, and you should fight for a championship once a year.
Well, that's an idea. Yeah, I just don't know how you get everybody on the same page. You know, they all seem to be.
That's the hard part.
They're not going to do it. Every other sport has something where everybody has you. So you need to tell me, okay, the L.A. Clippers, they lost, but fuck it, we're gonna go put them in there, and they're gonna fight in the world. Hell no, you lose, you go your ass home.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And your watch card is wiped clear the next year. You can start over. In boxing, you can't never freaking start over.
No. You can get delayed. You can get have a title on hold or a champion emeritus.
A new belt made for you.
No, you know what they need? They need teams. This is what they need, I'm telling you. Basketball team has a center. It has two or three centers. It has two or three point guards, two or three forwards, whatever, whatever, right? They need to make teams of boxing. You've got two or three welterweights, two or three junior middleweights, two or three, you know what I'm saying? And at the end, you allow your team to fight, and you allow your team to fight. You own the whole team the same way. If one of them get hurt, then let the other one fight, and you have a team of fighters.
Well, they have something like that in the World Series of Boxing, and it's—I don't know—it's interesting. It is actually kind of fun to watch team boxing when you are invested in it a little bit more. I'm trying to think of, you know, imagine a team with Floyd Mayweather on it and Adrian Broner. That could be grim, you know.
Well, that's isn't that the money team?
Okay. Well, they'll be like the Bulls were in the 80s, whatever. It's just how it is until somebody develops another team.
Right.
That's interesting.
And he wouldn't get to duck and dodge a whole bunch of people neither.
We're running out of time here. And we want to really quick.
I can't bother saying no, but. No, go ahead, Dave.
I'm just saying we're running out of time here with Ann. Really quick, I want to hear, what does the future hold for your prospect here, Ann?
If Chavelle has moved right and God continues to bless him, I think people are going to see the old school of boxing come back because I don't know no other way. And they're going to see, because a lot of people say it, oh, James, she just got James and he was just good. They're going to see, I mold this kid from 7 years old. They're going to see the true me that I can train. That's all I want to see. And they're going to see. They're going to see the sky's the limit for this kid. Because I'm going to train him to, well, whoever they put in front of him, I'm going to move him right. He's going to be prepared.
And we look forward to seeing that happen. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing, you know, how you guys progress and everything in this sport. And, again, I thank you once again for coming on Leaving the Ring. Can't wait to have you on again. I mean, I think we could have you on to the end of the show, but we got another guest that's going to be coming through in about 3 minutes.
Oh, no, I appreciate it.
You know,
all right.
I appreciate
thank
it. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Take care, Ann.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Evermost Big Figure of boxing,
man.
And the overall is Ann Wolf here on Leaving the Ring Radio. Every time we get her on, man, I mean, it's just, it's always epic. You know, she always walks away leaving her stamp in her interviews. I mean, the way she just formulates her words and puts everything together, her philosophy in boxing, and, you know, being a good human in overall, you know, by just saying it bluntly, you know, I don't care about boxing. This is not why I do it. These are the reasons to develop not just young men, but people, develop them to have a good character to move on in life, to have a better future. And, you know, God blessed her by having this way of attracting people and touching them, you know, through boxing. And
it's a thing, that it's a beautiful thing to watch when people are so giving, you know, and they're about, like, what I have, I give away, and it comes back to her, you know, and she now is another fighter, and you can just see it. Because you hadn't seen him, I kind of listened to you watch the fight over the phone, and, you know, you were like, oh, wow. Like, you can just see it. The way he
fights,
man, it's this dude, you know, somebody may get him, but it's going to be fun until then. You know, it's probably going to be fun after that. He's just one of those guys. It's the same way I felt watching James Kirkland. You're like, this kid goes for broke, and I like it. You know, he's going to need to learn how to settle down, like she said. But he's got a nice jab. He's 6 foot, 75-inch reach, but he can fight at 35 for a while. And even when he gets to 40 and 47, he's still going to be a problem as he fills out. I mean, that's still a tall dude for both those divisions. And you saw the knockout.
You know,
spooky
you know,
stuff.
The last time we saw a six-foot guy was by the name of Deo Corrales, and Did he leave his impact with the sport? Absolutely, man. If this kid can just kind of mirror just a bit of it, I think we got a hell of a fighter that Ann Wolf is bringing to the table. You know, when she said that she's not disappointed about what's going on with Kirtland, I understand exactly where she was going with it and how she feels about her up-and-down relationship with James. But the fans, I mean, we were just kind of disappointed. We're kind of like, man, you know, frustrated with him because we thought we were going to see him on a fast-track regimen again on getting fight after fight, and it just kind of seems like he went back to the abyss of wherever he's lost at. And, you know, I mean, she's not frustrated, but we are.
Yeah, right. Totally frustrated. It's kind of like, it's the same feeling as I imagine Tyson fans had when they kept waiting for years and they wouldn't let it go. Like, you know, if he just got in shape, he could take out the heavyweight. You know, he could do it all again. And James, we didn't even get, like, the good career that Tyson had. We got some flashes here and some pretty action fights. Like, his career set is actually pretty fun to watch. Like, every fight is pretty fun to watch. I think there's maybe one. The Molina fight is not that great. But it does end kind of crazy, so it qualifies as a Kirkland fight. But he just didn't – I thought he would be possibly a transcendent kind of fighter where it just he would catch on. Any casual fan I've ever shown a Kirkland fight immediately is like, when's this guy fighting next? I'm like, well, and therein lies the problem, you know. It is sad. It's just a career on the bench, you know. And I haven't talked to him a long time, so I'm not going to denigrate him and just side with one side, you know, of the thing. But, you know, Ann would know best, and she's never lied to me. So, you know, and never steered me wrong when she talks about him. And she kind of gave me the same answer when we talked a few days ago. And it was just kind of like she's respectful enough to not go into detail, but just say, you know, I'm here. If he wants me around, you know, I'm ready to work. I'm always ready to work. I'm always working. I think that's the problem. So, yeah, frustrating indeed.
Right. No, it is. I'm going to be calling in Brian right now on to Leave the Ring Radio, so just give me a few seconds.
He hasn't fought for a title, you know? That's, you know, kind of weird. You would think it would have happened, you know? But you disappeared calling in Brian Tovey. But, yeah, I mean, you think of, you know, Kirkland, he's already, what, he's 30 now. So it's that time. You know, he's fought for the regional titles only, I think, like three times, and according to BoxRec, actually, no, twice. So, yeah, it's a career that it's happened. It just didn't happen the way I thought it would, you know, and certainly the way Ann thought it would. He just turned 30, you know, March 19th, so, I mean, there's time. But with his go for broke style and his need to get momentum, that's the big thing. Kirkland gets out of shape, then he gets into shape, and you look at his pattern. He'll fight like two or three fights in a row, and that third fight is really where the payoff is. Are you there, Dave?
Yeah, I'm just talking to Brian, let him know that I'm going to be calling him in right now, so I apologize. So if you can continue what you're saying, I'm just going to call in Brian right now.
I will continue rambling about James Kirkland.
Hey, do me a favor. Talk a little bit about, Sean Porter, where he's got to go, where he's going now with that Paulo Malignaggi fight. And you know, actually, I want to hear your thoughts about Kid Chocolate.
I don't have that many. You know, I'm a big fan of chocolate. Kid Chocolate, not so much. I was pretty bored, I have to say. I mean, it's one thing to be in a mismatch. It's another thing to not take advantage of it. And he had a guy that was, a junior middleweight who would go rounds with people. You know, he went rounds with, like, Bison Gruoff. There was another quality guy he went rounds with. But, I mean, you're supposed to be a hard-punching guy that he knocked down Winky Wright, although he was, you know, pretty much in retirement. They kind of brought him out, got him a nice payday, and he went right back to retirement. But still, I mean, you go the distance with this guy. There's no finishing. There's no – I don't know what he's doing on the ropes, Kid Chocolate. Maybe he's killing himself to make the weight, and so he's just listless in there. I don't really know what he's doing. It does seem to me
he's
one of those guys physically,
right.
I think.
If he's fighting a subpar opponent and he struggles with them, it just kind of tells us exactly where he's at. He's a paper champion. Hey, I got our next guest here with us on Leaving the Ring. He's the writer of The Fix Is In and Larceny Games, Brian Tuohy. Are you there, brother?
Yeah, how are you guys doing today?
Good, man. Hey, thanks for taking the time to come on Leaving the Ring Radio and talk to us here a bit about your book and about the work that you've got yourself involved with. Let me ask you this, because I know that you got interested of what inspired you to write your book and kind of do your investigations a little bit about what's going on, the corruptions in the sport, but what exactly was it that caught your eye where you go, you know what, I'm going to look a little deeper into this and find out why this is happening?
I think one of the main reasons why I do what I do is because no one else does it, which is kind of an odd thing to say, but the truth of the matter is I don't see, you know, the ESPNs of the world, the Sports Illustrateds, Yahoo Sports, and all these other outlets really get into the dirty end of all sports, be it boxing, be it football, be it basketball, whatever. It seems like it's completely glossed over, and it's always, you know, unless the police uncover something, unless the police, you know, arrested somebody doing this, that, or the other thing, they don't go out and really do the investigative reporting that I think they should be doing.
There's no money in it, do you think, that in a sense, in the overall, or is it that at this point, like ESPN, let's say, you know, they're buying advertising, they're doing commercials with their anchors, you know, with athletes, you know, and they're kind of cutesy or whatever, or ironic is probably a better word. All that stuff, it's all too glommed together for them to keep perspective and really do our job, which is to speak truth to power, right?
Well, I think that's the big thing. Is like you said, one, there's not a lot of money in investigative reporting, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be done. I mean, ESPN's making plenty of money where they could fund an investigative unit to dig into these things, but the problem is, you know, the ESPN pays the NFL $1 billion a year. They pay the NBA $1 billion a year. They're not going to then turn around and investigate these leagues, these players, these coaches, the referees, all of them, and look for corruption within it, because that's shooting themselves in the foot. I mean, that's right. The scary part for me is the fact that really all the sports outlets, and there's really only five major sporting outlets media-wise in the United States. I mean, you got ESPN, Fox, NBC, Turner, and yet, you know, they're also the sports media. So they broadcast these games, but they're also the ones who give us the coverage of the games. And really, it's a huge conflict of interest. There needs to be somebody outside, some sort of oversight, if you will. And it's the same thing we should have in every media, you know, be it business coverage or political coverage or what have you. But in the sports world, it's really symbiotic relationship between the leagues and the media, and it's hard to get inside it all.
Let me ask you this, because when you talk about mainstream media, how many guys have been off the record with you where they've said, hey, you know what, I totally agree with you. I wish I could say this, but unfortunately I got a gag over my mouth, and you know, because I could possibly lose my job and my place where I'm at.
Well, you know, I haven't had a ton of contact with the higher-ups, you know, with the Bob Costases, the Dan Patricks, Jim Romes of the world. They seem to ignore me, and I think they do so purposefully. From my personal perspective, I mean, I think I've been censored, if you will, by not being allowed to be on certain programs. But, I mean, I have heard from, I mean, I know for a fact, you know, there's beat writers and other guys who will not publish certain articles because they know it will affect their livelihood. You know, you write the wrong story about the wrong team, you lose access to that locker room, and you can't do your job anymore. I mean, that's a reality. That's a fact, and it's happened before. So, I mean, I know it exists. It's just a question of, you have to look at, if you look at a lot of the books that have been written that are critical about sports, and I mean, some of them are very old. I mean, there's like Interference, which is about the NFL, which is from the 80s. There's one called Short Circuit that's about tennis that was from the early 80s. And you look at some of the other really critical books about professional sports, none of them are written by sports writers. They're all written by guys outside of sports who took an actual critical, honest look at these things and found problems, found corruption, found game fixing and fight fixing and that sort of thing. It's very hard for somebody who's inside, I think, one of these leagues to write this sort of book because they know it's kind of their death knell. They're going to have to do it while they're leaving their job and moving on to something else if they do it at all.
Right, right. No, I agree with you. So let me ask you, what is the right now by far the most corrupted sport out there in the world that most fans are not really able to, you know, get a glimpse of what you're seeing or what myself or my co-host, Mr. Gabriel Montoya here, are seeing out there?
Well, I think, unfortunately, every sport has a level of corruption within it. I think the biggest one, the most obvious one, I think, is soccer, which is interesting because it's the biggest sport in the world. It's the most broadcast sport in the world. The World Cup is the biggest sporting event in the world, and yet we know matches have been fixed in the World Cup. We know soccer matches are being fixed all over the world. I mean, we know it's happening. We know tennis matches are being corrupted. We know cricket matches are being corrupted. We know boxing matches have been corrupted. I'm pretty sure UFC fights have been corrupted. In my opinion, I know that NFL, NBA, and Major League Baseball games have been corrupted, all by gamblers. That's not what I think the conspiracy theory end of it, where I think the leagues fixed their own game. I'm just talking about gamblers and the organized crime element within sports gambling. I know they've corrupted all of these sports, but yet nobody talks about it, nobody writes about it.
And you haven't had anybody, you know, I'm pretty sure we get tons of hate mail because of what we talk about PhDs and HGH and stuff. I'm pretty sure you're getting the same amount of volume of hate mail, fans telling you to shut up and don't talk anymore. But has anybody...
That's the funny part. I get no hate mail. I really don't. I get love mail, if you will. I get
you're
going to
start getting them now,
Brian.
After being on this show, you're definitely going to start getting them now. I said, after being on this show, you'll definitely start getting them now, man. No, but listen.
And that's fine. I don't mind. If people want to argue with me, I'm happy to debate these things with them. But it's the reality. I mean, and that's the problem, I think, is
right.
People don't understand that sports are, in fact, entertainment. And because they're entertainment, they're subject to a different sort of law, and they're actually subject to a different perspective. And I think if you realize it's entertainment, you realize it's all a show, and then you start looking at the corruption within it, I think it becomes very obvious what it is, what it truly is. And I think it takes a fan to be willing to take that fan hat off and look at it as a business, look at it as entertainment, and then you see how real this stuff is.
Well, let me ask you this.
I wanted to ask, why is the NFL tax exempt? Just kind of a random, I don't know, sort of maybe changing course a little bit, but it's just – that's one of the strangest facts to me. It's like, I mean, we don't tax churches, but the NFL?
Yeah. Well, the NFL has a lot of breaks they've gotten from the political arena. I mean, look at the arenas. Look at the stadiums. How many of those are being paid for by tax money, and yet the owners of the teams keep all the revenue from those arenas? How many teams are getting tax breaks who have gotten free land like they did in New York to build both the Yankees and the Mets stadium? They got free land. You know how much land is in New York City? How expensive it is, and yet they just gave it to the Yankees. They just gave it to them. I said, here, don't go anywhere. We'll just give this to you, and then we'll give you tax breaks on top of it. I mean, it's amazing. And, I mean, again, if you want to go to a conspiratorial level, I look at it in many ways as like the gladiator games in ancient Rome. I mean, they put those on to distract the people so the government could get away with certain things. Well, at the same time now, you have a lot of people who are completely distracted by different sports, whatever, you know, they're sport of choice is football, baseball, basketball, what have you, and at the meantime, look how crazy our political system has gotten because not a lot of people are paying attention to it. They're spending all their free time on sports, which the government, in a way, is funding.
Very, very true.
Wow.
That's interesting. That's fascinating. I mean, you think about
it brings it down when you think about it, doesn't it? It's a little depressing, but again, if you look at it in a different angle, different light, then you kind of see this and you realize, oh, geez, that's true.
Well, it's kind of funny is that I've been a sports writer now for 8 years. I'm in my eighth year. But, I've been a hardcore sports fan my whole life. But the more I've stayed in this, like now I just follow football and kind of follow – I'm a Rams fan, so we only get like half a season anyways. But, you know, I'm a boxing fan. And I kind of keep up on the Lakers, but, like, I'm not – I don't go to games. I'm not, like – I don't spend any money on them, really. But coinciding with that is I've become much more politically aware. Well, I wasn't when I was really just a hardcore watched every game kind of fan, and I'm actually paying attention to things I should be. That's an interesting point that you make. I mean, I think it's – look at the Olympics. How much money do we throw at that? How much good could we do with that money instead of doing what we do with it? You know, there's opening and closing.
Oh, exactly. And, I mean, that's where I came from. I mean, I started off the same way. I was a great sports fan. I mean, that's all I thought about, sports. And then – as I got a little older and I got certain things pointed out to me, I read a couple of books, like the two I mentioned before, like Interference and Short Circuit and They Call the Game and Out of Their League. As I read some of these alternative opinions basically about sports, it made me stop and think, well, geez, is that really how it is? And then when you change your mindset and you start watching the games and you start seeing things, you're like, well, you know, like in football, how does instant replay still manage to screw up a bad call? How can you have a call where the guy's ruled out of bounds and you see on instant replay he's clearly in bounds, but the referee comes out and says, no, you know what, he was out of bounds. I mean, how does that happen? And
right.
My opinion is it happens because it's happening for a reason. It's not just a screw-up. It's a screw-up with a purpose. And I think if you look at games and you look at them in a different light, you see more often than not these accidental, intentional calls that are incredibly bad that get people up in arms, but you know what? You can't do anything. It still makes the game result what it was, and it still gets the league in many ways what they want. And that's where I think if you start putting all these things together, it really is kind of a conspiracy because, and this is the main fact that I try to point out, is that it is not illegal for a league to fix its own game. And that's the big thing. It's not if the NBA wants to fix its own game and they want the Heat to win, they can fix every game they want and make the Heat the world champions, and there's nothing fans can do about it. There's nothing illegal about it. That's how
I was reading up on that. That blew my mind away.
Where's that written, that's not illegal? That's crazy.
There's no law. There's no law that covers it. There's one law called the Sports Bribery Act, and that covers if I were to pay a coach or a player or a referee to alter the outcome of a game, that's illegal if I did it. And there's also a law on the books that dates from the Quisho scandals of the 1950s that says you cannot alter the outcome of an intellectual contest for television purposes. But there's nothing that covers a league telling its employees, which the referees, the coaches, and the players are their employees, how to do their job. And if that means, hey, don't call these penalties, hey, do call these penalties, hey, don't call these plays, hey, throw this interception, hey, throw this ball away, that's perfectly legal. That's just an employer telling an employee how to do their job, and they can do it all day long.
You know, the thing, too, is that these guys have these high-paid lawyers that can find the loopholes. I mean, like the intellectual word there, I think you pointed it out in one of your articles, Brian, was that was the key word because it didn't involve sports. There's nothing in that whole paragraph that said sports, you know? You know what I find very interesting is that, you know, when Mondays come along and you have that water cooler at work is how you talk about sports, like, for instance, boxing. I'm a huge boxing fan, and this is what the show's solely about all the time is boxing. And when I mentioned the word boxing, the first thing a fan would say was go, yeah, I don't watch it because it's so corrupted. But then when I start mentioning some of the stuff that I've been digging up about the NFL and NBA, to me, they just kind of seem like, you know, like what? Like they've never heard of this. How do you think that these major sports have kind of kept this hidden, you know, where fans are not, or is it just because fans are just not, they just don't want to accept that their sport could be corrupted at all?
Well, I think part of it is being naive. I mean, I think boxing has the history of being shown it was corrupt. I mean, boxing in the, you know, we know from the late 40s on, boxing was controlled by organized crime in the 40s and 50s. In fact, one guy by the name of Frankie Carbo literally ran the sport of boxing in the United States. I mean, for about 20 years. I mean, this guy was a member of Murder Incorporated. He was known to have been a killer. And then when he kind of faded off, then came Don King. And Don King, you know, was known to be a murderer. He was known to be incredibly corrupt. And, you know, I think people, whether they just had a cursory knowledge of boxing or not, heard enough there's something wrong with the sport. But the NFL, you got to remember, really the main commissioner they had was Pete Rozelle. And Pete Rozelle's background, and he came aboard in the 60s, was public relations. It was PR. And he knew how to control the media. He knew how to spin the media for the league's benefit, and he did that incredibly well. And I think he was able to keep a lot of the fixing and gambling stories that came about in the late 60s and early 70s in the NFL out of the press. I mean, that's one of the reasons I wrote Larceny Games, is because there was so much stuff I found that never got the press coverage it should have. It should make you question the history of the NFL. And I think the other leagues learned from that. So the recent history of those sports were really, in a way, covered up and willingly covered up by the media and the leagues themselves. So people don't know this history. They don't know this corruption within their sports. And when they do learn it, like you say, they either laugh it off and say, ah, that never happened because I never heard it before. Or if they do look into it, then they start going, well, maybe I need to really think how I look at these games.
I mean, even in following up and doing my research, you know, finding that trial that the NFL suits were involved, they even put themselves in the category of a business and that their business is in entertainment, which basically was saying that they script their games like a play and they had already had like a pre-written ending. But what I've seen with fans is, okay, you have so many people involved in NFL, NBA. How can these guys set up certain pawns to work together as a domino? How do you think that happens, Brian?
Well, I think it's very easy actually to control the outcome of a sporting event. And you can do it with a minimal amount of people. I mean, there was one gambler who said, I could fix any football game you want by controlling three players. Give me a quarterback, an offensive lineman, and a defensive back, and I can alter the outcome of any game. And I think you can do the same thing with referees. I mean, if you've got a referee or two in any sport, you can control the outcome of the game. Certain penalties called, penalties not called, that sort of thing. The NBA or college basketball, you get one player, you have 20% of a team. If you have a team operating at 100% against a team operating at 80%, which team's likely to win? I mean, it's you only need
right.
one guy in many cases, and I think you can get one guy because, let's face it, athletes are people too. Referees are people too. They have problems. Some have drinking problems. Some have drug problems. Some are taking performance-enhancing drugs. Some are homosexual, and that can be exploited. Some have gambling problems. Everybody's got problems. And the mafia has learned over its history how to find the weaknesses within people and exploit it. And I think if, you know, we know that organized crime can do it, why do we think a business like the NFL can't do that to its own players? Because let's face it, in many of the cases with the players, where else can they go to make the kind of money they make playing in the National Football League? Nowhere.
Right.
And
nowhere.
Many of them have
exactly.
really sacrificed their lives up to that point to get into the NFL. So once they're there, and once they get in, caught in some sort of trouble, and the league, I think, could be very easy to come to them and say, hey, look, we can out this, we can make this public that you have a cocaine problem or you're a steroid user or whatever, or you could do this for us and lose this game or do whatever that we need you to do for the, just once. Just do it this one time and we'll let you go. And, I mean, you know, you do that enough, you can alter the outcome of a season or even, you know, a championship. So it's not that difficult.
So all the puppet masters, do you believe that are involved in this and making these things, you know, to create these fixed games, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, like I say, it's the owners. It's the owners of the league. I mean, you know, every year in the NFL, there can only be one team that wins the Super Bowl. It's only one team that's going to win the NBA championship, only one team that wins the Stanley Cup. But because there's so much revenue sharing, especially in the NFL, where they share almost 80% of every dollar made, regardless of where it comes from, they have a benefit of seeing certain storylines go on into the Super Bowl and win that championship. And I think that's a big thing. A team can go 0-16, yet basically make the same amount of money as the championship team will make. That's how the NFL is structured. So I think when a team or a league has a certain storyline, they have certain athletes they want to promote, or somebody comes out of nowhere and becomes a superstar, they're willing to push that on longer than it should go because, again, this is entertainment. People want something to talk about, the sports media will latch on to whatever the NFL throws them or the NBA throws them. So they're willing to push certain people, certain teams beyond their natural point just to make sure that storyline continues and makes everybody more money.
Wow.
Let me ask you something specific. You know, I mentioned I'm a Rams fan. Super Bowl 36, Rams versus Patriots, fixed or not fixed?
Well, I mean, it was completely fixed. Yeah. Well, I think that was one right after 9/11. You had the whole Patriots,
yeah.
You know, the whole team aspect, and the whole NFL really changed its mindset after 9/11 to promote this whole patriotism idea. And if you want to go back to the fact maybe the government has a say into these sorts of things, maybe it was some sort of propaganda on top of it all, too. But just look at the game itself. You can see where the Rams receivers were just mauled by the Patriots defensive backs. I mean, just mauled. And yet no flags
yeah.
are called. No, you know, there's no pass interference, no holding, like it didn't exist. So, I mean, something,
right.
it's that easy to do. It really is. So, I'm certain that game was fixed, but fixed for a purpose. And that was the league's purpose. Maybe even Las Vegas's, but mainly the league's.
Let me ask you this really quick.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
That makes me feel a little bit better.
He's going to hang himself now, Brian. Let me ask you this. Because I'm doing a segment about boxing versus the NFL. The NFL was crippled the way boxing has been in the last 20 years of not being on what people would consider free TV, which there is no such thing. But if the NFL was shunned away from the major networks and taken off of NBC and Fox, and they had to go and the mercy of the cable networks, could the NFL survive? And do you think that would make a major change in how it is organized?
That's a good question. I don't know how well the NFL would do. It's really hard to say because they make about $6 billion a year right now from television revenue alone. That's over like 60% of their money comes directly from the television networks. So if I don't think they can go to like a pay-per-view type of system unless they were charging a boatload for every game you tried to purchase on a pay-per-view level. I mean, they can go to cable because, let's face it, ESPN, like I say, gives them $1 billion a year. DirecTV gives them $1 billion a year for that exclusive Sunday ticket package thing. They would have to find more deals like that to survive, because otherwise, if they get off of CBS, if they get off of NBC, they get off of Fox, the leagues are going to take a serious pay cut, and that's going to affect everybody, from the owners all the way down to the players. So I think they need that kind of, you know, what'd you say, regular broadcast television outlet, and they need the money that they're paying them, because otherwise the league can't survive. Now, Major League Baseball could probably survive because of ticket sales and local television, same with the NHL and the NBA, but the NFL really requires that national-level audience to get the money it makes.
Do you think the reason why the NFL and all these other corrupted soccer are able to get away with this, too, is because it's legal. It's actually legal for media to lie to us. Do you think that's a big part of why they are able to get away? Because they can make a phone call and tell media to write a different way, a different wave of stories to get out there for the mainstream fans to read on?
I think the main reason they get away with it is because the fans don't necessarily care enough. Really, unfortunately, I think
that's so
the
true.
Case.
Yeah.
The fans, they may call the NFL a sport, they may call boxing a sport, but they really, I think deep down they understand they're being entertained. And they want to be entertained. They want that three-hour escape or whatever from the family or from their problems or whatever it is. So I think they're willing to accept kind of the illusion and the fairy tale because deep down they really want that. And I think, you know, if the fans rise up, if they make a stink about something, and they kind of did that with Major League Baseball in the steroid era. I mean, they were fine with McGuire and Sosa hitting all those home runs, and then Barry Bonds came along and was a jerk about it. And then suddenly Major League Baseball fans are like, well, this is ridiculous. You know, these guys are taking steroids. He's hitting 70 home runs a year. This just ain't right. They kind of rose up, and then Major League Baseball said, well, we better do something about the steroid problem. I think if fans did that more often, if they started taking the leagues to the mats about certain subject matters, about like concussions in the NFL, steroids in the NFL, which is completely overlooked, and some of the other problems like tanking in the NBA and that sort of thing, fighting in hockey, they could actually change these sports and make the sports better, but they just want to be entertained, so they just sit back and do nothing.
You know, I want to be entertained, but if I'm laying down a bet or if I'm, you know, spending my hard-earned money to pay for my cable or to buy tickets and go out there, and then I read about a stadium or the owner of the league, you know, fixing the game, that would, you know, I mean, I don't understand why fans won't be pissed about that, you know, because you're getting something that's scripted. You're not getting something organic. I just don't understand some of these fans out there, you know. I mean, I'm lost for words. I can't believe that this happens.
Well, I think you look at the NBA and tanking. I mean, I think that's a clear evidence of what I'm talking about, because the players aren't deciding to lose the games on purpose. The coaches aren't doing it. It's coming from the general manager, the owner, that says, we want a bad team so supposedly we can get a better draft pick. Well, if the GM and the owner can tell a coach and then therefore the players, don't play well, lose this game, we don't care. If they can do it in the regular season, then why can't they do it in the postseason? Why can't they do it in the championship? Why can't they say, hey, lose game three and game four because we want this playoff series to go to six or seven games? I mean, if you can do it in one place, you can do it everywhere. So where else is it occurring? I mean, I think, and that's the thing. I mean, NBA tanking has gotten so bad, it's become so obvious that it actually is getting attention, that it is getting press. And yet at the same time, people still go to 76ers games. Like, why? Why are you going? You know your
right?
team is intentionally losing, and yet you're tuning in. You're seeing the highlights on ESPN, and you're paying money to go sit in the seats. Why? I mean, how blatant can it be, and yet the fans keep going. So, you know, it really emboldens, I think, a league to continue to do this sort of thing. And like I say, I don't think every game is fixed by any means. I think it's done, you know, when it needs to be done. When they see certain profit from certain players like Tim Tebow, they'll push these things along. But I don't think every game is fixed, but it's enough can occur where it should make you really question what it is you're watching.
We got Brian Tui here on The Fix Is In with us here on live on Leaving the Ring. Go ahead, Gabriel.
You know, our sport, you know, looking at boxing, we certainly earned our reputation for being shady. But, you know, we're in a sport that's in transition right now. I don't know how much attention you pay to us, but we're kind of heading into a monopoly situation is what it looks like, because the sport is so wide open. It's not a league. It's the exact opposite. We have different promoters all over the world with their own stables and their own connections to each networks, all kind of doing their own things in their own regions. But here, in the U.S., we've got Top Rank, who kind of is with HBO, and you've got Golden Boy, that's Oscar De La Hoya's company, and they're with Showtime. But they're kind of run by, they're rumored to be run by a manager, advisor named Al Heyman. He's like signing up all the talent. He's basically a manager. He's just signing up all the fighters. And it looks like the beginnings of kind of an attempt at a UFC kind of thing. And it's not the first time it's happened. Don King tried to do it. But when you look at all the leagues and the kind of corruption that they've got going, and you look at our sport and the kind of corruption that it has being so unregulated but headed towards a monopoly, what do you think like a league would look like in boxing? And would it be more or less corrupt or the same?
Boxing would be less corrupt the more wide open it is. I think when you concentrate power, and that's one of the things that bothers me about the UFC, is the UFC went out and basically has bought up all their competition. You're an MMA fighter, if you're not fighting in the UFC, you're not fighting, basically. So they own it, and yet they sold themselves basically to Fox. So now it's Fox Sports and the UFC. To me, that's a scary monopoly because that means when they have things like Fight of the Night bonus and when they have to have these pay-per-view events, they have to make it entertaining. In fact, the Fight of the Night bonuses basically forces the fighters to try to be entertaining and get rid of all the grappling and the submissions and that sort of thing. They want the blood, they want the violence, and they want to sell it to Fox Sports, and Fox Sports is buying it. And then at the same time, to make these pay-per-view events, they have to keep coming up with new, almost like professional wrestling, they have to keep coming up with new and exciting events to get people to tune in. And I think boxing had that problem back again, 60s and 70s, especially with King and that and HBO. And yet that didn't mean fights haven't been fixed. I mean, that's the scary part. Is
right.
They still have to make it entertaining. They still have to make an event. And to do so, I think sometimes guys take dives. And it's like I said, you have a history of boxing. Unfortunately, you have over 100 years of it that's proven that it's happened. And to think it doesn't happen in the UFC is incredibly naive. And to think it doesn't happen in boxing today is naive. It's the way of the sport. It's to create
big-time
events where everybody makes the money.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they do it with the matchmaking. I think the UFC fans are not necessarily boxing fans that switched over. Some of them are, but I think a lot of them are more wrestling fans that now get something a little more real. Or they were just they saw the first 10 UFCs before it really blew up, and they're diehard fans. But yeah, they don't really understand the concepts that are behind the scenes, like matchmaking, the way boxing does, because it is so much longer. Its history is so much longer. I think they're getting it now. But they don't know when a guy is totally passed and being fed. A lot of times, I'll have my strictly only UFC fans tell me that. Like, oh, watch this fight. It's great. It's going to be evenly matched. And you look at it and you're like, no, it's not. This guy's really old and beat up. And that's all what you're watching is kind of a setup. Do you think we should stay away from monopoly? And you think that a free market is best for our sport in terms of being able to regulate it overall and get all the things that the athletes need?
I think so, because I think, like you said, if you look at when, especially boxing was, HBO owned these guys. Like you say, the Fox owns UFC to a certain extent. I mean, you had things like when George Foreman made his triumphant comeback, the fat, bald, old man. I mean, Freddie Pacheco, the fight doctor, wrote in his book, every one of those fights was set up. Every one of them was fixed. And that was because he was a draw. And I forget who covered it. It might have been Showtime, might have been HBO, whoever. But somebody owned all those fights. And so they're making money hand over fist by having George Foreman in this remarkable comeback by this 40-year-old fat guy, which, made no sense. But here it was, and they're broadcasting,
right.
And everybody's making money. And they're all happy. I think the problem, to a certain extent, is it is a business. And when you get an entertainment entity like one of these major networks involved with it, you have to make it entertaining. Whether it is or whether it isn't, you have to make it entertaining. You have to try to make a spectacle of it because that's what's going to get people to tune in. So I think the more unregulated, in a way, the more a free-for-all it is, it would be better for the sport, because I think when it does come under one entity's control, then they control everything. They control it all. And a lot of times the people involved, the fighters, have no way out. They have to listen.
I agree with you, because these networks, they're not, first off, they're not sport fans. They're business guys, you know, that just want to generate money and keep lacing their pockets and stuff. Let me ask you this really quick, Brian, before we let you go. How did you obtain those FBI files to write your book, The Larceny Games? How did that come to?
That was all through the Freedom of Information Act. I learned how to work that system through the FBI, and I obtained every file they had related to what it's called sports bribery, which is basically game fixing, and that covered college sports. It covered the NFL, Major League Baseball, the NBA, boxing, horse racing, and a few other crazy things mixed in. But it took me probably a little over two years to get them all. But that's what I did. It was all just through the Freedom of Information Act, and I was actually pretty much the first person to ever access any of those files. So with that, the other thing that bothers me is you go back to like what we started talking about, and these other, you know, major broadcasters, the Jim Rome's of the world, they have the power to root out some of this corruption, and they do absolutely nothing about it. So it falls to some goofy guy like me to do all of this. I'm the one who did it. So, you know, Bob Costas could have written this book. Some other guys could have written this book 10, 15 years ago, but no one bothered to. Nobody wanted to.
That's fantastic. No, it needs to be done. You know, it's we've done a lot of, like, investigative work here on the show and myself on our site, maxboxing.com. And it doesn't make you popular, but it has to be done, right? I always wonder about the writers that kind of get in. And I think our sport, more than any other, like, maybe now it's changed with blogging and all that, but you could just come right in. And within six articles, I was ringside getting a credential, no degree in journalism, not really knowing what I was doing. Luckily, I kind of found my way to kind of out stuff as I found it. But there's a lot of people that don't. They just want to meet the athletes and, like, hang out. What are your thoughts on like, new media? And do you think it strengthens the ability for investigators to work, or does it dilute it by adding all these fan sites? And you've got, like, 10 or 20 guys that are just really don't belong there, that aren't even reporters. What are your thoughts on the media, where it stands these days?
It's good and bad. I think you're right. Part of it is that there's so much, especially sporting content. It's amazing how much sporting content is out there. It does.
Yeah.
It really dilutes it all. And if somebody does come up with a good story, a lot of other guys, you know, jump on it and basically steal it and put it on their own website. And you lose track of who actually really came up with this, and it gets changed and altered, and it goes to hell. But at the same time, to do real investigative stories, you really need money and time. And I think it's very hard for independent people like myself and perhaps you guys to really have the money and the time to dig into certain stories and really get to the bottom of it all. And I think that's good for the leagues, because then they can cater to the big guys and shut. But at the same time, it bothers me that the big guys have the time and money to do these things and they don't. So, yeah, it does. Maybe, you know, one independent guy has to work on one story for 6 months to try to get something out. But the problem is then, and again, you guys might experience it, you write a good investigative piece that roots out some sort of corruption, and all of a sudden the next time you go to get credentials, they won't give them to you. Or the next time you try to interview a boxer or a manager, they won't talk to you because, you're the guy who wrote this piece. What are you doing to me?
Right.
And that's the thing. So I think if you have, whatever NBC or a Fox or somebody behind you backing you, then those guys can't necessarily shun you as easily, but they can still do it.
Well, we've been called all the way down to vigilantes compared to, I mean, like from other media, and even fighters ourselves. But, you know, Brian, I mean, this is just some great stuff. I told Gabriel earlier today that I was really excited about getting you on. I know that, you know, our schedule has been conflicting about when to get you on. And I think it's, you know, timing was just perfect, man. I don't know. I think I'm all questioned out. How about you, Gabriel? You got anything else to ask Brian here when we have a moment?
Probably can keep it going, but we actually have 20 minutes left. We have to actually talk some boxing here for the next week. But, you know, Brian, we got to have you back on, man. It's fascinating and to meet kind of, a similar, we're birds of a feather, you know, the kind of investigative work we do and the fearlessness with which you do it. I think it just takes to having to stand outside. Like, there's guys like, you know, Jeremy Scahill, Glenn Greenwald, they just launched their new The Intercept, It's kind of for independent journalists. And those guys, yourself, it gives me hope to just keep doing what we do, you know, because it's not a popularity contest. It is about just telling the truth as it is so that everybody knows.
Well, and I think the truth will sell. I mean, I think it can make money. I think it can be profitable.
Sure.
It's just you just kind of have to slap fans around and go, hey, wake up. Look at this. Stop reading that crap. Stop reading all the top 10 whatever lists that keep popping up and all the slideshows and all that nonsense. Take some time. I know it's a, you know, internet age and everybody wants things on demand and they have to watch the YouTube video, but, you know, take 20 minutes and read a well-written article and maybe you'll learn something and maybe it'll change your thoughts. And I think, you know, if you keep pushing that angle, I think people will come to it because, like you said, I think the truth does sell and I think it's more interesting.
I just love the fact that I can be at a water cooler now and nowadays, and when I talk to, you know, fellow employees or other sports fans and I talk boxing, they say, ah, it's a corrupted sport. I have the biggest grin in the world, and I'll say, really? Let's talk a little bit about your sport. Thank you, Brian. I appreciate that, man, getting that information.
I did have one thing. It just popped in my head. Unannounced testing or announced testing? What would you classify the NFL's steroid testing as? I've heard several stories.
I think it's announced. I think they know it's coming. I mean, I had a guy who's a member of the pro football. What's that?
Like 2 weeks out, I've heard they get warning.
Yeah, I mean, I heard from one guy who's a member of the Professional Football Writers of America, and he said at least 75% of the league, if not more, is using human growth hormone, which, you know, they can supposedly test for it, but they still don't test for it. So, I mean, it's not necessarily steroid, but it's certainly a performance-enhancing drug. And, you know, we know there's drugs out there they can't test for that guys are taking. I mean, you look at the NFL players today, and you look at a guy like Cam Newton. I mean, he's, what, like 6'4", 245? I mean, he would have been like a lineman, an offensive lineman 30 years ago, and now he's a quarterback. These guys are bigger, faster, and stronger than ever before, and I don't believe that's just because people today are bigger, faster, and stronger than ever before. I think it's because they're taking something to get that big, that fast, and that strong. And that's leading to these concussions. That's the part of the concussion debate that bothers me, is always bringing up the fact that these guys are bigger, faster, and stronger than ever. And their collisions are more violent than ever, and that's part of the reason why more guys are getting concussed.
And they're wearing suits of armor, you know? Like, why are we surprised? What if we went back to the original, no face mask and just little leather helmets with these guys these sizes? I don't know how many games they'd last, but, you know, maybe everybody would go a little easier.
It wouldn't be as violent. Yeah.
Well, there you go. I mean, again, we could have you on for hours and hours, man. Really, just great stuff. Great to meet you.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime you guys want me back, feel free to hit me up.
I definitely will, man. Again, we have Brian Tuohy here on with us. You can buy his book. He's got two good books out there, Fight Fans. If you want to go out there and purchase them, he's got The Fix Is In and The Larceny Games. You can purchase that at thefixisin.net.com. And be sure to follow him on Twitter. Brian, again, thanks, man, for coming on Leaving the Ring Radio. It was much appreciated.
No problem. You guys have a good day.
You too.
Wow. And that's some good stuff there, Dave.
Really, really good stuff. You know, I mean, God, you know, I knew that this was an interview. I mean, this was an interview that I really wanted, and I told you that. And it was something that I didn't know how I wanted to tackle. And to tell you the truth, I didn't know that Fight Fans, whether how they were going to receive it. I'm hoping that they received it very well, and I'm hoping that they learned something from it. And then also that there's some weight lifted off your shoulder knowing that, hey, boxing's not the only one that's in shambles. Boxing's not the only one that's in that dark corner. The other sports that we thought were in this, like, grand light, you know, where when you mention football or any other sport and they had the hallelujahs behind it, well, they're really being distant now because we're finding out that, hey, there's trouble in other homes as well, not just in our house. But, hey, let's get down to our fight schedule. Let's talk about what's going to be happening this weekend here as soon as Mr. Gable Montoya pulls up the schedule. Again, don't forget, Monday nights, you got the next round with Gable Montoya and Steve Kim. And then Tuesday, you got Boxeo Tijuana Radio, all Spanish network, that you guys can tune in. I listened to last week's show. It was great, phenomenal. I had a great time listening. I was busting up with the two guys that host the show, which is Felipe and Resno. They do a fantastic job. And then us, like always, Leaving the Ring Radio, where we try to bring you something different all the time. We don't try to stay on the same norm. and try to replicate what other people were doing. We kind of, you know, kind of danced to our own beat. But let's go with that fight schedule here, Mr. Gabriel Montoya.
All right, then. Thursday, April 24th, that's at the Aguascaliente Casino in Rancho Mirage, California, on ESPN2. Josecito Lopez versus Aaron Martinez, junior welterweights, 10 rounds. Thomas Williams Jr. versus Enrique Ornelas, light heavyweights, 10 rounds. Going up to Saturday, April 26th, at the StubHub Center in Carson, California. On Showtime, we got Keith One-Time Thurman versus Julio Diaz, welterweights, 12 rounds. Lucas Matisse returns after his loss last year to Danny Garcia versus John Molina, junior welterweights, 12 rounds. Omar Figueroa takes on Jerry Belmontes, lightweights, 12 rounds for Figueroa's WBC title.
You know, some interesting fights. Josecito Lopez, obviously, is a comeback type of deal. You know what I mean?
That's what we're talking.
I mean, you know, when we talk about it, we just had Brian Toohey, man, so it's kind of hard to, you know, compete with that right now. We had him on with us here, but
let me dive in.
Go ahead.
It's Omar Figueroa.
Take the big guy.
Let's that one.
Let me roll up my sleeves after you then.
All right. Yeah. It's like this card, well, look at it, though. You know, Nihito Arakawa, that fight with Omar Figueroa, it was July last year. That took so much out of Figueroa that he hasn't fought since. It's almost been a year, you know. It's been quite some time since the young man has laced him up. And it makes you wonder how he's going to make the weight. It makes you wonder how did he heal from that fight? What did that fight take from him? That was a brutal, brutal fight. And so he takes on Jerry Belmontes, who's, you know, they're 19 and, you know, three, he's got five knockouts. Perfect guy to take on because, he's probably not going to do much against Figueroa. So it's kind of a mismatch on TV. So, I mean, the fight is only intriguing because I'm wondering what Figueroa has left after, you know, and what he's going to be like after a year away. He's an action dude, and he took some shots in that fight, but Belmontes isn't the guy to take advantage of it, so it doesn't really matter.
You got to point out, though, he's had some hand injury, too, as well, so I'm wondering how well his hands hold up in this fight and when he connects on the dome.
Sure.
And, you know, I mean, so, you know, when we talk about the fixes then, the fix is to see where Omar's at, build back his confidence, see where his chin and his head's at, his hands, how well they've, you know, how healthy they are. Not necessarily fixed, but if you want to talk about something that's visual where you could see something that's supposed to happen when we had, you know, Brian Toohey on with us and we talked about how the NFL referred themselves as a entertainment business. So meaning that they're, you know, some of their games are scripted. This is in the same type of form, you know, same deal, is that Omar's to come back, to make a comeback, to see him get further in his career to those bigger fights. So you have to kind of script a fight for him that can have a warm body, give him some rounds, and see exactly where the kid is at before they throw him in with a bigger shark.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I mean, yeah, this is exactly what we're talking about. You know, it's just, okay, we're going to watch Omar Figueroa win, and then after that, we're going to watch Keith Thurman win. In between, we're going to watch Lucas Matisse versus John Molina in a fight that, I don't know, what do you think of this fight?
I actually like this fight. Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I think
honestly,
it's an appropriate fight.
Here's the thing with John Molina. You never really know what you're going to get with him. I mean, what happened with DeMarco was, you know, I don't think anybody thought that was going to happen. A first-round stoppage, you got caught. Was he cold? Did DeMarco really hit that hard? I'm not really sure. Molina has kind of left us like, Mickey Bay went out there, was landing some hellacious shots on him. He took him well. Same thing with Hank Lundy before that. So we know he could take a punch. We don't know what happened with the DeMarco fight.
And we know he carries his punch late, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, we know he can turn it around and right up to the last second. And that, even when, I mean, you know, I was rewatching that fight with Bay, and I thought it at the time, and just every time I watch it, John looks like he's disconnected heading into that last round, like in the corner. He just looks like he's given up. And
right.
Joe Goosen's there, like, talking like, hey, man, you know,
Are you listening to me? You know, are you here? And John kind of like takes everything in that he says, but I kind of didn't believe him. And then he said, even in the round, like he got hit and Bay looked like he was going for the finish. And that's what his switch turned right then. Like, oh, hell no, I'm not kidding. You think you're going to finish me? And then he came back and he gets the finish. John is a trippy guy. I feel like he's like a Kirkland. He hasn't quite had the career that I thought he would. He hasn't been active. He hasn't let it fully out. Even with those like the Lundy fight and the Bay fight, it's like they're flashes of what John could be.
I don't know. I think
he's one of my favorite guys to talk to. But I want to see him let it out. And I think this is the kind of fight where we could see that.
You know, I don't know. With me watching John is, I think you get what you're going to get every time out. I think that's the best he's ever going to be. He's going to be one of those wild cards that he can win one night and he can lose the next night. Lucas Matisse was definitely outboxed by Danny Garcia, and he was hurt. And Danny wasn't there really to receive the hard-hitting end of Lucas, where John Molina definitely is. You know, he's a very stationary guy. He's slow. He's not the fastest, combination thrower out there. But he does have consistency when it comes to throwing that right hand. He's a guy that can catch you at any moment and any given time in the round, and he can hurt you and turn that fight around. This is a really interesting fight. I'm wondering, though, that with Molina's style, is it going to be appropriately matched with Lucas Matisse? Because Lucas needs you to be there for him to land a big, heavy shot. Now, if he's able to land that big, heavy shot, which I'm pretty sure, I mean, you could throw a rock at John and you're going to hit him. If John can absorb whatever punishment Lucas has, how quick-fated can Lucas Matisse become where then he ends up getting the receiving of what John's going to do back to him? And in a lot of ways, I think this is by far the most exciting fight that we've had leading up to this month. You know, I think through the 4 months that we're into the whole new year, I honestly think this is a very competitive, very interesting fight, and we're going to have a lot of explosion between these guys. This can end early or this can end late. But I tell you what, there's going to be a lot of bumps and bruises, Gabriel. There's going to be a lot of bumps and bruises in this fight, and it can end short where we don't get that fulfillment that we're looking for, or this could be a potentially fight of the year kind of candidate fight, because these are two guys that are fighting to stay established in the rankings, to stay notable in the fans' eyes. This is a crossover fight for them, for the both of them, in my opinion.
Yeah, I haven't made it a pick yet, and I'm not going to until probably the day. Keith Thurman versus Julio Diaz welterweights. Keith Thurman,
a lot better fight.
Like three or four rounds, like three rounds.
You know what? I wouldn't argue with that about that. There's a strong possibility. But Keith Thurman, to me, is a guy that he takes rounds to figure you out. He kind of feels out what you bring to the table. He almost kind of flirts with the arsenal that you bring. I've noticed that with him. You know, he'll allow you to hit him. He'll allow you to do certain things. And then he makes that full adjustment. To me, he's not a complete fighter, but he's almost close to it, because he'll watch your mistakes. And then he capitalizes on it, and he capitalizes on it, and then he takes everything away that you brought to the table. He'll clean that table, you know, clean, and then he does what he wants. I honestly think, though, Diaz is not what everybody thinks. You know, everybody, every time he comes into that ring, everybody says that he's going to get blown out, and then he doesn't. It doesn't really happen. Amir Khan's got fast hands, more athletic, great hand speed when it comes to combinations, and he had trouble with Diaz. I think tend to believe that Keith Thurman is going to have a little trouble with him for those first two, three, four rounds, and then he's going to turn up the heat, he's going to adjust, and then I think that late knockout is going to come from Keith Thurman. But like I said, I think Diaz does bring that veteran into play. He's smart enough to understand what he can do, and he's going to show us a little something where it's going to scratch our heads for a few rounds, but it's going to be all Keith Thurman in those later rounds, in my opinion. So I got Keith Thurman by late KO. I'm gonna pick the upset with the Molina and Matisse fight. I'm gonna pick Lucas. I'm gonna pick Molina. I think that he can stop Lucas Matisse on like in the seventh or eighth round. If he's not stopped early by Lucas.
I'm gonna go like Lucas in five. If I have to make a pick right now,
But you never know. That's why, I mean, John is like one of those guys. You just never know. And usually when I pick against him, I'm wrong. So there you go, John. You're welcome. Finally, at the Koenig Pilsener Arena in Oberhausen, Germany, on ESPN2, Vladimir Klitschko versus Alex Lipay, heavyweights. 12 rounds for Klitschko's WBA, WBO, and IBF titles, as well as, you know, he's the heavyweight champion. History in the making is what it's being called. I don't know why.
Just like the moment.
I could tell you. Yeah, it's the moment where everybody realizes, hey, we're paying for bullshit.
No, I said this on Twitter. I said the only, honestly, the only chance that Madonna has is if he has Manny Pacquiao's mom on, in the audience doing the voodoo, you know. But hey,
she, yeah, well, yeah, that's, she only does that for close relatives, though. She doesn't. Would it work? You know,
I don't know. I don't know.
Is it universal? The Santeria?
How does the magic work against the greatest?
That is your weekend.
Listen.
Oh, actually, you know what? Let me read this because we're not going to get to the show.
Let me just throw this in really quick. How does the magic work against the greatest Houdini of boxing, Floyd Mayweather?
Wow, that's true. Well, she went all David Blaine. She was all street magic on him. You know,
go ahead.
And she was like holding the credential, and it's crazy. Monday, April 28th, at the Coliseum, Ruben Rodriguez in Bayamon, Puerto Rico, Fox Sports 1. McJoe Arroyo versus Alicia Aquino, super flyweights, 12 rounds. Michael Perez versus Jorge Romero, junior welterweights, 10 rounds in action. That's the Bad Left Hook TV schedule and your weekend fight schedule. There you go.
Well, there you go. Fight fans, enjoy your weekend. Enjoy the fights tonight. And remember, don't drink and drive because you'll spill your beer. I'll talk to you guys soon. See you guys next week on Thursday.
Peace.